You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. This is Betty Levette's triumphant year, her 50th in show business. She's trumping Aloud. Miss Levette now rivals Aretha Franklin as this generation's most vital soul singer, proclaims the New York Times. Betty Levette's life is a life worth remembering. She is, as the title of her new CD says, thankful and thoughtful. By the age of two, Betty Levette could, she says, grind to the groove. At her school talent show at a Catholic school in Detroit, she ignored Sister Bradford's offer to find suitable material and instead gave the assembly of students, priests, and nuns a taste of the coasters, "I'm a hog for you." This is a woman who speaks her mind, and she started doing that from the get-go. Levette knows how to spin a tune, and she knows how to tell a story. She knows what it means to be a star. In her own inimitable words, she not only loves music, she is music. Compromise raw soul and you end up with no soul, she says. Detroit, New York, Memphis, Honey Cole, Stevie Wonder, Otis Redding, Cab Calloway. Betty Levette's career has taken her from the peaks to the pits and back. At 20, she landed out on the street barefoot with no possessions. She sung at the swanky Cafe Carlyle and in 2009 at President Obama's pre-inaugural concert at the Lincoln Memorial. And you'll hear some of those stories tonight. Levette is aided in her memoir by award-winning writer David Ritz, who will interview her tonight. David has collaborated on autobiographies with, among others, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, B.B. King, Etta James, and Cornel West, and he is the author of two novels. He co-composed the song Sexual Healing with Marvin Gaye and has been nominated for 5 Grammys and has won 1. You'll see for yourself tonight that Betty Levette is a woman who likes being alive. As she says, in the way she sings, and in the words that end her unflinchingly honest memoir, "A Woman Like Me," she really is a woman who loves being alive. Please welcome David Ritz and Betty Levette.
Yes. You're wonderful. Baby.
So here we are. I'll tell you a very quick deal, and then I'll be quiet. Well, not all that quiet, but I'll try to be quiet. We met a couple years ago, and I was in the middle of doing a million different things, and she was in the middle of doing
a thing.
Was at the Jay Leno show, mm-hmm. and her manager Eric is here. Was kind enough to call me and told me, "Boy, you got to go meet her." And I had loved her music forever, but we had never met. And what's on my mind was, I don't have time to do her book. I got too much to do. I don't have time. And after meeting her and having her talk to me approximately 4.5 minutes, I said, I got to do this book.
I thought you were going to say hours.
And so I just love you, and I love the way she sings. But even more than that, for my own kind of literary purposes, I love the way she talks, and I love the way she tells stories. So I'm in love. So I'll just,
I love you too, David.
End it with that. But any event, so we're going to do now what she and I have been doing for the last couple of years, which is kind of kicking it with each other. Let's begin where I guess we all begin, with sort of mom and Dad, because as you described them to me, they really came alive, and they're great, great characters, and I just wish I could have known them. So kind of tell us a little bit about your mom and Dad and how they came to Detroit and how this whole thing began.
With all the reality shows today, can you just see them?
They would tear it up. They would tear it up.
You know, I don't know what to tell you, except I had some unusually wonderful parents. They were, I don't know, maybe they were fun because they were drunk, but they weren't, it wasn't the drunks. Everything in my life has been a little different than what you've maybe heard of in other episodes, you know, that were constructed the same way. But my parents were, I never saw my mother nude until she became ill just 10 years ago when she died and I had to care for her. Never saw my father nude, never heard my mother call my father anything other than a bastard, and never heard my father curse at all, and these people were drunk all the time. So they were pretty unusual, and they loved music. You know, music was, you know, when they had the arguments or whatever, which happened after I'd gone to bed, there was music playing over the arguments. So they were always involved in music. But I think the thought of, I think that people tend to think that as a small child, well, I've always dreamed of being a star, and why would I dream that? I didn't know anyone else who was a star. I mean, it was not my dream. I did not sit and dream to be a star. I didn't know anyone else who was a star. I had never seen a star. I had never seen a microphone, and there was no reason for me to have dreamed that. But I knew the songs, and when I did meet people who were capable of at least putting me on stage, I already knew the songs. So
let me ask you this. Because before we move into your being a teenager and getting into the whole sort of Detroit teenage music thing, one really moving thing to me was when you described their little club at home, their little private scene with the jukebox and how you performed as a child, because that was really the first time.
Where we had my mother made barbecue sandwiches and fried fish and chicken sandwiches, and they sold corn liquor by the shot. A shot, I think, was about 50 cents. You could get a half pint for about $3 and maybe a pint for $5 or something like that. And these were bottles, of course, that they had collected from, as they called it, bonded liquor, which meant liquor that was sold in a real liquor store. And they would, you know, scrape the label off of it, and they would just have these pint bottles and half pint bottles. And that was what they did. I mean, it was... they never looked at it, I think they never looked at it as more than just a means to an end. If they had looked at it like an enterprise, I think they really could have made real money. But they didn't come from the group of blacks that looked enterprisingly. They looked at the group, they came from the group of blacks who, we need to make it until next month or until next week. And with the jukebox there in the house, there was no... meeting, you could not meet other women at my house. You could meet your wife there. Maybe she'd come and get you and keep you from spending your whole paycheck. But it wasn't it wasn't cussing and womanizing or anything. It was the music. It was the chicken sandwiches, the fried fish sandwiches, and then the singing, you know, which would happen from the various gospel groups that would come through Western Michigan at that time, 1946. They had nowhere else to go if you were going to have a drink after your gig. And it's so many things in this book. And people ask me, David, I got to tell them about... The main thing that people ask me is, was it easy writing the book? And I thought it was, because I thought it would be like a conversation. But I would tell this story, which I've told for 40 years. I've known everybody at Motown, either drunk or naked or broke or all three. And everybody would laugh like this. But David said, which ones? And then after I'd answer that, he'd say, and what were you doing when they were doing this? And so it was far from conversational. Mm-hmm. But
returning to when you got in front of the jukebox and did...
Oh, well, I would just sing the songs. You know, I would sing the songs and they would throw quarters or nickels or whatever. And I could roll my stomach like all the way down in a roll.
That's what
all the way back up. And if, you know, you think about now child molestation and that whole thing. And I don't know what everybody, of course, I'm sure my parents didn't know what everybody there had on their minds, but no one ever bothered me or anything. I would pull my dress, I had on a diaper. I would pull my dress up and I could, in time with the music. Do you know how flat you could keep your stomach if you could do that? It's just, I've tried it, and I could see that if I could do that for 15 minutes every day,
That's good. Now, jumping ahead to...
See, he never wants me to tell the good part, just a bad part.
You become a teenager. So now we're in Detroit, 1961. Motown has begun. You're sort of beginning to hear all this activity. You turn 14, 15 years old. How do you enter into the Detroit music world?
Everything was so connected then. You could be involved in church and still knew people who were involved in numbers. Drugs consisted of maybe marijuana. If anybody took any heroin, everybody just avoided them. And nobody could afford cocaine, but really rich people, and there were no really rich blacks. So that didn't even, everybody, if you said drugs, you were talking about marijuana. And you, it was alcohol other than that. But becoming involved in the music business in 1962 in Detroit, 60, 61, 62, it was nothing. All you had to do was just be available. Everyone was either a producer or a songwriter or a singer, or they were in a group, you know, as a singer. So it really wasn't as mystical as it may sound.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Your career, the beginnings of your career parallel the beginnings of Motown, and yet they don't intersect. How did that happen? Tell us how you did your initial recordings and why that and why you never went to Motown. Because you had jumped ahead.
Well, I never went to Motown because I just hadn't gotten to them. Mm-hmm. Someone got to me before I got to them. But when I realized that this was something I could do, I could actually sing, you know, because so many people were singing. But you have to realize I was just coming out of like the ninth grade. Mm-hmm. So even though there were a lot of singers about, I didn't know them. Mm-hmm. And the entertainment always went on in my house, so my parents never went to nightclubs or to see shows or whatever. So I had never seen a show. I'd never seen a microphone, as I said, until that first night that I held a microphone. Motown was nothing to do at that time. The sensation was that I was signed by Atlantic. You know, that was the biggest black producing record company in the world at that time. So to be with Motown, it was just another broke little fledgling black company that year. Mm-hmm. But everything happened so fast. My record came out in 1962. By the time my next one that sold came out in 1965, gangsters were calling me to their offices in New York saying, who is this guy, Berry Gordy? You know, it was moving so fast. They wanted to know how are these records, and this poor man was driving these records around in the back of his Buick, you know, 54 or 55, 56 Buick, I can't remember. But it still wasn't a big thing, but it was catching on so quickly. Everyone in New York and in Chicago wanted to know, who is this guy? What are they doing? How are they doing this? You know, but it wasn't of interest to me. At that point, I was living in New York, and I was with Atlantic, so I didn't care.
Just just kind of returning to the recording of your first hit, why don't you tell us that story? You know, how you were called and who was involved, and because I love that story.
Well, there was Ginger. First I was attracted to, of course, all the glitz. And then I met Ginger. Ginger knew everyone who owned an Eldorado and everyone who had ever held a microphone. And she had been to bed with all of them, so they all knew her personally. I adored her. My mother hated her. She could only come to the house when my mother was at work. And as soon as my mother would go to work, I'd call her and we'd get together and she would take me and introduce me to these various people. And she introduced me to the proverbial guy who says, hey, you want to be a star? And that was what it was. He was a local singer who had a local or regional record. That would mean it would be Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, that area. And he had a producer, Johnny Mae Matthews. His name was Timmy Shaw. And Johnny Mae Matthews was, as we look in retrospect, she could very well have been the first black female producer, maybe in the world. But she was such an awful woman until no one carried on her legacy or to say, you know, yeah, well, this woman helped me. The only thing you may have known about her is if you saw the Temptation story and the really rough woman, I've forgotten who played the part, came up and beat them up like she did me, beat me up and wouldn't give me my money. And she heard me and he told her, well, as he promised me, I can get you a record, you know. And he told her about me, and she had a song called My Man and taught me how to sing it. I mean, verbatim, word for word. She said, my man. I said, my man. She said, he's a whole lot of man. I said, he's a whole lot of man. It was literally done like that.
So you record it. It gets out there. It is picked up by Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you're on the label of Ruth Brown and Ray Charles and Solomon Burke, and you're in the big time.
So you know what I cared about the people over at Motown.
Right. They were shit compared right, to what you were doing.
Right.
But what about the first tour? Because you had never been on a tour before, and here you're going out.
No, I've never been anywhere. But in Mother Nesta's classroom.
Right. But now you're going out, you're touring with Otis. I just tell us a tiny bit about the early tour.
It was an Atlantic tour. If you were at that time, you could actually pay a nominal fee and see a very good show consisting of five or six artists, two or three that were coming up, and maybe two stars. There's always maybe five people on the show. If it was local, there was what was called a shake dancer, then a comedian, and a male singer and a female singer, male star and female star, a male group, and you know, but you saw a variety of a show. So when I went on the first tour, it was Atlantic artist. My new record was out on Atlantic, and there was Barbara Lewis's, whose Hello Stranger and whatever was out, but that went kind of pop and kind of white. So she wasn't on the tour that I was on with Clyde McFadder and the Drifters. And Clyde McFadder could go in and out. He could, like, go to the white side, come back to the black side. Poor Otis Redding and I, we would be on the tour until about Baltimore, and then we had to turn around and go back south. Everybody else went to onto the Apollo. The first time that Otis had the opportunity to go to the Apollo was after These Arms of Mine. It got to be like 98 in the pop charts, I mean, but it just broke in. But he was so sensational to watch, and New York was always just completely gullible for anything that was a performance on stage. He had the opportunity to go there and be on the show where I, while they liked my voice, I was just kind of, my man, he's a whole lot of man. And it was, so I didn't quite make it to the heights of New York. Mm-hmm. But the other, the groups that were around, the Drifters, were from New York, Atlantic. The other artists on Atlantic were from that area. So it was Barbara Lynn, Clyde McFadder, Benny King, Otis Redding, In and Out, and Clarence Frogman Henry. Mm-hmm. And I think that was it. Was that it, Daddy?
So,
yeah.
So you go on this tour, you have high expectations. The song does okay.
Oh, no, I wasn't expecting anything.
I hope.
No, I wasn't expecting anything. Uh-huh. I was there and thrilled to be there. I wasn't expecting anything. Mm.
So you do not have high expectations.
See, and that's how it was with the book.
And so you're out there, and you're grooving and moving, and you're a happy camper and all this stuff, and then it doesn't quite happen the way you want it to. Now, that is because of a managerial thing that gets you to New York, but it's probably worth telling the time. It's probably worth taking the time to tell us how you got to New York the first time and what happened once you got there, because that's a major kind of shift.
Oh, well, I was my manager, the way I got on Atlantic, mm-hmm. Johnny Mae Matthews, who had been the producer of my first record, mm-hmm. who was the crook of life. She got
the
with like
life.
The second crook of life, mm-hmm. by who became my manager, Robert West. And I didn't know that when people sell your records to record companies, you were supposed to get some money too. Well, that was my first record, and they didn't teach me that in the ninth grade. But that happened. My manager, who became my manager, Robert West, also managed a group called the Falcons, who had had a big record called You're So Fine, and then another record with Wilson Pickett called I Found a Love. And those records had been really big. Then Wilson left. So many things happen so fast, it's hard for people to understand how quickly all these things happen. In like a month's time, Wilson Pickett left the Falcons, became Wilson Pickett. His manager took me on. The Falcons quit. They got a new, all this in like days, just days. My manager decides he's going to get with this guy whose name is Herman Griffin, who is married to, who is the biggest rhythm and blues female singer, maybe next to Baby Washington at the time, Mary Wells. And she is going to leave Motown. They're going to start another company. I'm going to be the, what, maybe Ruth Brown of their new company, and Mary Wells is going to be the Doris Day or whatever of their company.
That's good.
And they went to New York to work out the deal, and Herman Griffin, Mary Wells' husband, wound up shooting my manager. Bullet went through his eye, through his brain, and he never recovered really from that. I had been singing for maybe 6 months. I knew West, the Falcons, I knew Jerry Wexler on the phone, I knew my booking agency on the phone, and I knew the Falcons and the local artist in Detroit. This was all I knew. So I'm there with no manager. I don't know what I'm going to do next. So all of my friends who know all about show business came to tell me, you should leave Atlantic and go for bigger and better things. I didn't know where the damn bigger or better things were. So I have no idea why I went to New York to tell Jerry Wexler, I'm leaving Atlantic for bigger and better things. Said, you poor baby. He took out his own personal checkbook. He wrote me a check for $500. He said, you're going to need this so bad. And he ain't never lied. Oh, it was just awful. He told me, I said, I want to be with Lieber and Stoller. They had done all the big records on the Drifters and Clyde and everybody. And I knew all of their songs, so I thought he would write me something just like theirs. And he said, well, there's this new guy who's had this big success with this girl named Dionne Warwick. His name is Burt Bacharach, and he's going, he ain't no Lieber and Stoller. I want to release from my contract. So so he gave me one, and that was the first big mistake I ever made in my life.
In approximately 4 minutes, describe the next 10 years of what happened to you in New York.
Mercy.
You can begin now.
I did not know that shit could turn to honey, and it did. Or that you know, yeah. I did not know that it could reverse the other way. I was walking down the street being a young person one day, and suddenly I was a recording artist. And then suddenly I wasn't. I meant just everything just flipped around. You know, so I didn't know what to do. I mean, this wasn't a thing that I had been long lived in, and I really didn't know what to do. So I was just there. I was just there in New York, being already a has-been, and I'd only been singing for two years, and it was so, I didn't have sense enough to know that while I was being a has-been then, I was already a never-was, because nobody really even knew what had happened to me. It had been just a small rhythm and blues happening. I was kind of like the female, what they would say then, they'd call it a Jimmy Reed record. That meant that it would sell 50,000 copies, and that was it. You could depend on from 35 to 50,000 copies, and I was in that niche. But I had only done that once at that time, so I had no nothing. I had no absolutely nothing until I ran into I just met everybody. I mean, still, even though it was New York, everybody who was black who was in show business, if you knew about them or if they had heard your record, you kind of ran across them. Or certainly when you got to Harlem, you ran across them or got to know them. Or if they knew you, they'd say, I've never met you, but welcome. And so that kind of went that way, which is how I got involved with Don Gardner and DD4.
Yeah. So you had... there was a club up in Harlem where you, with sort of, that club sort of became your home.
Well, and this was Small's Paradise.
Right.
I mean, this was a really big deal.
Right.
At the time, it was Wilt Chamberlain's Small's Paradise. Mm-hmm. Ed Smalls, who had owned it during the 30s and 40s and 50s, had died. Mm-hmm. And Wilt Chamberlain, who had just become a big basketball player, had bought it. But it was still in Detroit when I read Jet Magazine and Ebony Small's Paradise, and Sugar Ray's and the Baby Grand were where everybody went. And that was where I wanted to be. And that was where I went. And just fortunately, I walked in, sung a song, and Don Gardner hired me on the spot.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to, those who want to read the more Andalus parts of your New York life.
You better figure on it.
We'll purchase
it right.
The book, and we won't go into it now. But somehow you survive New York for 10 years, 12 years. You play
well,
the
no,
little club.
It wasn't that long. It was intermittent. It was mm-hmm. back and forth.
Right, to
the
Detroit.
Just surviving that first... 3 or 4 years, it kind of made the next ones easier. That first 3 or 4 years where nobody knew me, you know, nothing had happened. After I did get the Let Me Down Easy record, most of the people in the record industry in New York then knew I was there, mm-hmm. knew what I had done, and, mm-hmm. you know, so things changed on some levels.
And also, one of the interludes of your career that I love to hear about and I loved writing about with you was when you went on the Broadway touring company for Sugar. And kind of tell us about that and Cab Calloway and how you became like how you moved from being an R&B vocalist to be able to have a major role in a Broadway production.
Well, that all, we can't skip over Jim Lewis, who started to manage me in 1969. Mm-hmm. And this was he was very big in the Musicians Union in Detroit. And he changed my life, not because I felt it needed changing, because I thought he was stupid and old. And he wanted me to sing all these old people's songs, Sarah Vaughan and Billie Holiday and whatever. I was like, I can't sing like that. And he was saying, I don't want you to sing like that. I just want you to take your voice and apply it to real good songs. And if you do, you'll be able to sing and work for the rest of your life. I cannot guarantee you you will be a star, but you will be able to make a living as a singer if you will listen, which it took me maybe 10 years to do. I'm still having a little trouble with it, but but I did eventually listen to him, and when they call for Bubbling Brown Sugar, I mean, think of my contemporaries. Think of everyone you know that's close to my age. None of them knew all the words to Sweet Georgia Brown and God Bless the Child, and I felt stupid for knowing them. None of my other friends knew those words, but he taught me, oh, and in my solitude, I was like, oh, God, no one ever wants to hear this song in life. And the people call from Broadway and say, well, okay, she can have the starring thing to show if she can sing Sweet Georgia Brown, God Bless the Child, In My Solitude. And I'm like, I can't believe this. And she's got to learn to tap dance. And I said, but I can't tap dance. I mean, you can't just get up and leave your house and tap dance. And Jim said, yes, you can. And they told me, the producers and the choreographers of the show, they said, can you dance at all? And I said, yes. They said, well, you learn those dances. It's just another dance. And that's, you know, what it turned out to be. I don't know that I ever became a proficient tap dancer, but I did become able to wear those silver tap shoes, that white tuxedo and white top hat, and hold on to Honey Cole's arm and onto Cab Calloway's arms and just do my little steps up to the top. I never got a bad review.
And yet that was an interlude as opposed to a new career for you.
Of course, everything we thought was going to be
the just coming didn't happen. And so that after Sugar and after, you know, this long or, you know, relatively long period where you have work, you have steady work, you return to Detroit, return to the little local clubs and the lounges. And
oh, not before I got checked into the hotel by Donnie and married him on the stage between the shows.
Right.
Then I returned to Detroit.
Right. The shorthand version. Here I am leaving out one of the husbands. That's not good. that's not good. But anyway, you return to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Return to the funk. And the grind, and now Detroit is destroyed, and it's going through its thing, and Motown is gone. And how did you emotionally cope with those years just before you caught on again? I mean,
well, there had been in that time, there had been the Motown thing, mm-hmm. which was them recording an album on me. After all those years, mm-hmm. I finally wound up recording for Motown in 1982.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like they recorded it, pressed it, and put it over here. And it was just, I mean, it was, if you looked for it, you could find it. Mm-hmm. But that was about it. But at this point, I was living in New Orleans, actually, before I came back to, after I married the guy who checked me in the hotel. Mm-hmm. We moved to New Orleans, actually. He became a hotel manager for the Hyatt. But I worked in New Orleans, and that was the first time that the things that Jim had taught me had come into play, because when I landed in New Orleans, nobody knew about Bubbling Brown Sugar. Nobody knew any of these records that I had that almost sold. But I knew the words to St. James Infirmary, Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans, just everything that Jim had taught me. Mm-hmm. And I just walked in and sung a song and got a gig that I worked until I left New Orleans. But these were the things he was trying to show me. You will always be able to work if you can entertain people and you know the words to really good songs, mm-hmm. which I did. And worked there for the longest before I got back to Detroit. And still, that was helping me. The only gigs, of course, you had the gigs where like the hottest band, the hottest singer or whatever was working locally. Of course, everybody who owned every club by this time when I got back to reclaim my local gloriness all these people were gone and whatever. So I had to walk in again, like I did New Orleans, and just walk in and say, them the Scott Shook. And none of the other singers knew how to do that, so I could walk in and take these gigs, which Jim told me I would be able to do.
We only have about 8 minutes left, so everything in shorthand, everything in shorthand.
Okay.
How do you explain how it began to turn around, like how you got here now? You're touring internationally, you have a deal, you have a book, you have a wonderful husband, you have two wonderful cats. I mean, how you have a house in the burbs of Jersey. How do you explain in shorthand when that turn happened? When all these years of almost, it's going to happen.
It really all happened at one time. Well, I'm sure that when my husband thinks about it and everybody else involved, they know if there was a year between this or 6 months right. or whatever. But 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago, it was actually people just before 10 years ago. I always joke that I actually knew every fan that I had. I knew their telephone numbers and addresses. Really, people were offering me, you can come and stay in our extra room. And the people who did love me, loved me. I mean, sincerely loved me. This was a different thing than Elvis Presley's fans. All they do is go down there and look at his grave and whatever. These people were paying my car notes and more. Really, they really were friends. And they got to be, just 10 years ago, big enough to do something to actually, literally help me. So at one time, 10 years ago, a friend from France went to Atlantic, found my Atlantic album that was supposed to come out in 1972 that was never released, released it on his label because he could finally afford to. My friend from Holland had enough money to bring me over there to do a live album. He did it at the same time. And then a friend from New York got me, who was a president of a record company, but couldn't get his record company to sign me. So he got me a deal with another record company. And they did a record which won a W.C. Handy Award. And all of that happened at the same time. And then this man called and said, hey, I'm a fan of yours. I've been liking you for a whole 11 years, and I don't think you should let anything that's happening to you be happening. I said, have you got any money to do anything different? And he said he didn't. So I said, well, then go to hell.
Talking about your husband.
But then he came to Detroit. Well, I ain't going to say what I said. But anyway, he came to Detroit to apologize for being so forward, and he brought this with him. but really, it literally all, it was kind of like, I got the road manager, I got the booking agency, the record company, the all of it, all kind of at the same time to me, even though they happened like maybe a year apart or 6 years, or 6 months or 9 months apart. For me, it seemed like it all happened at once because it had taken 40 years to happen. And then for it to happen inside a year or two, it all seemed like it happened at once to me. But I can afford walkers to match all my outfits now.
All right. I'm going to ask you one other. I'm going to ask you one other question, and then we'll have other people ask questions. But I really want you to tell the story, because to me this was one of the highlights, and I've probably looked at this video on YouTube, and if you guys haven't, you can and you should. Maybe 100 times, because every time I get a goosebumps. How did that whole Kennedy Honors thing come about when you were asked to do the Who song?
This one. This one out here. The people, I mean, he... How in the heck do you find a husband who loves to be on the internet and who just seeks out everything Betty LaVette? He saw that they were doing a tribute to George Jones. I had just done the Choices on my album at that time for Anti. And he got with my agency and with everybody he could and said, like, can't she come and honor George Jones? And the producers said, you know, everybody's coming from Nashville to honor him. The only song that is left is a song by The Who. I said, The Who? And my husband, who knows every song that was ever recorded by anybody in the whole world, he knew the song. And I said, but it doesn't make any sense to grown people. But my brilliant, brilliant arranger, Rob Mathis, listened to me sing the song and did this wonderful, wonderful arrangement for me, which I adore. And before I got to them, we talked to Michael Stevens, who is the producer of the Kennedy Center Honors. And he looked at me on, I think, David Letterman doing Little Sparrow. And I guess he said if she could do a Dolly Parton song, she could do a Who song. And I meant, if somebody calls you to be on national television, they want you to do Mersey Dotes and Dozy Dote, whatever it is. So I said, songs really are songs to me. I chide people, and my husband included, and my manager about the songs that came out in the 60s and 70s and how they have little candles and altars built to them and whatever all around the house. They're just songs. And so I learned the song because the arrangement was written for me, and the arrangement I loved. And the arrangement has made me love the song, and loving the song, I was able to make Peter Townsend like it. And he told me so, and he kissed my hand, and he cried.
But we need a little bit more kind of graphic detail on that story.
On which one?
On this one. Like who was in the audience? Because when you come out on stage, you are going to kill, and you kind of know it, right?
Well, when I walked out on the stage, I knew that I had a job to do. It's, you know, I'm 60-something years old. The thought of not doing it, I certainly wasn't going to do like the president did on the debate. There was Aretha was sitting right here. Barbara Streisand was sitting here, and Beyonce was sitting over here. I call it my Three Stooges slap.
All right, on that happy note,
and
that's what I want.
And I had on a size 6. I loved it. I loved it. It was like a gross apology. It was just like an apology from everything and everyone and everything and everyone.
Well, now you guys understand why I had to, after talking to her a couple minutes, I had to change my mind and hurry up and do this book. So if anybody wants to ask anything, ask.
What was the name of the Who song?
Love Rain Over Me.
Love Rain Over Me.
Which I pronounce Love Rain Over Me.
In all the years that you were pursuing music, what made you keep going when things weren't working out? How did you find it within yourself to just keep pushing forward?
Oh, baby, I quit. Every time some sugar turned to shit, I quit. Really, I quit all the time, but I've always been fortunate with people, you know, not the industry, but people. As I said about the fans, I mean, I've really had people saying, here, one man and his family sent me a picture of their house and squared out the room where my room would be if I came. Really, and that has always happened to me. I've always been fortunate in that way. I've never had to leave and go join a church or sleep in a car or even like some of the things you may find fearful in the book, I kind of put myself in those positions. It wasn't ever that things got so bad until I had to be in those positions. Men have always liked me. Their wives have always liked me, and their children, and people have always taken care of me. I've always looked at the line from Streetcar Named Desire when girlfriend says, I've always depended upon the kindness of strangers.
Hi, you really blew me away with your performance at the President Obama's inauguration concert. And I was wondering if you could talk a little about how you got that gig, and did you choose the song, and did you already know Bon Jovi before you sang with him?
No, the same producers of the Kennedy Center Honors, they were fortunate. They felt themselves fortunate to get that gig to do the inaugural celebration. And I had just done the Kennedy Center Honors just a few months before, a few months before. And they called me to do that. And I mean, it's like calling a black person to sing an Angel's Gonna Come is like Amazing Grace or something. I mean, and I knew that I could only, I mean, just sympathize with Bon Jovi. But he is just the sweetest, cutest child. I had never met him. And he was so gracious to me. And I always tell it when I talk about the drive-by truckers, I think if these children weren't cordial to me, it wouldn't have been on my part because I wasn't nice at all. They were just really cordial to me and, you know, kind of left room for me to be, you know, abroad.
Hi. How old were you when, and who was the first person to tell you how the business side of music was real? What you had to do to survive to keep being an artist?
Well, that's the person in the book called Jim Lewis, and when I first met him, when I came back from New York after New York had beat me up the very first time, and I came back to Detroit. He said, you've got a great voice, you got a cute booty, but you can't sing. And you're going to have to learn how to sing if you want this to be your life's work. He was not talking about it in terms of being a star at all. He was just talking about me going to do a gig really good and being good enough to get a decent wage, which is really pretty much all I'm doing now. I'm known by more people, but I certainly know that you know. I mean, you can look at this room and tell that there's no Beyonce-ness going here, you know, but I've learned my craft really well, and if I had to, without a band, stand here and do an hour show, I could do it, and he made me learn to do that.
I love in the book when you talk about what you learned from jazz musicians and your kind of initial resistance to that. Could you talk about that a little bit? That was a beautiful part of the book.
Well, I didn't feel I was learning anything from them. I thought that Jim wanted me to sound like them because he was old and they were old. And he just wanted me to sound old. I mean, I was like 18. You know, I talk in the book about the night we're coming from this place in Detroit where everybody went, the place where Diane had her little altercation. But I told him we were riding, coming from the place, and he was like, you should learn this, and you should learn that. I said, shit, Sarah Vaughan can't sing. He said, put me out of the car on the freeway. I swear to you, and didn't ride off and come back. He left me there on the... He said, you're too stupid to ride. You're just too stupid to ride. And I thought for a long time that he really didn't... It's so stupid, you know, in retrospect. Why would he keep me there and keep spending his money and having arrangers write songs for me? I thought he didn't like me, and I thought he didn't like the way I sung. It's kind of like when you're young, you think your parents don't like you because they're like, you aren't doing this right, and you aren't doing it right. Oh, you don't like me. But that was really what it was. I thought he didn't like me. So I thought he was just keeping me there. I have, like, just somebody to beat up, talk about.
Sarah Vaughan can sing now. And do you appreciate
she's
those
she's still
songs?
Not one of my favorite singers, but I know how difficult what she did was to do. You know, after I did become valid enough to choose favorite singers, she didn't turn out to be one of my favorites, but I can't do what she did, and I understand how difficult it is to do it. Same thing with Ella Fitzgerald. She doesn't evoke any emotion from me. But I listen to her sounding like a trumpet and a saxophone at some times, and I know that I can't do that, so I have great respect for it.
So who are your favorite singers?
Do you hang with David? I have, because I've been forced to kind of think of them and mention them, most of them are, most of them actually are white women and black men. Ray Charles would probably be my favorite singer because his voice is not beautiful, but he's interpretive. And I had to learn that my voice didn't have to be pretty or mellifluous. It could be just interpretive, and I learned that from him. But I like I'm not a music enthusiast, so I don't sit and listen to music. So to have a favorite singer or somebody I could listen to all the time, there's somebody I could listen to any time where it wouldn't annoy me to hear them. But there's anyone I like to listen to all the time. I like old movies, anything made before 1950, few things after 1950, anything made before 1950, and politics. And that's what I look at all day long. And my husband is in the office playing music. Honey, listen at this. And I'm like.
Let me.
I'm sorry. I like Doris Day. I like Judy Garland. Because I always wanted to sound like a girl. So those were the first voices I liked. So I practiced trying to sing like a girl. And Jim's chore was to try and show me that it was okay to sound like Louis Armstrong. And that was really hard, a hard pill to swallow, because all the other girls sounded like girls. Oh, gosh.
Bobby Bland. Look at
Marvin
that.
Gaye. Marvin Gaye sounds like the girl I wanted to sound like.
I'm David.
David Ruffin. Willie John. Sam Cooke. The thing about the singers I like, everybody agrees they're good. It's not even a matter of opinion. It's a matter of fact. Everybody likes the singers I liked.
Let me ask you one other sort of a large question, and then I guess we've got to go. But this is an important thing to me. So this is out now, and we haven't even talked about the scandalous parts of the book.
There are no scandalous parts of the
many,
book.
Of which there are many. But do you know one thing, honestly, that I want to ask you? A lot of reporters and articles have, as they do, you know, this is a long, not a long book, but it's a deep text, I hope, and they've pulled different deals out of context, and you did this, and you screwed this guy, and blah, 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 and you know, how does it, because this is really the very first time in your life when you've told the story, mm-hmm. you know, from beginning to end. And then you have these reporters and magazine newspapers kind of pulling it out of context. Well, she, how are you sort of reacting to all this? And is it hard?
Not well.
Or are you angry? I just
not
want to hear.
Well. I just the book is written about people that you know as legends. I know them as people. This is how we acted and performed and cavorted then. What I was doing was not looked at the way it was would be looked at now. I think one of the things that most perturbed me was a writer from England said that I had an affair with Aretha Franklin's husband. And it's not true. First of all, it was not her husband at the time. And then he was a pimp. He was not a husband, you know. Whatever I did with him, she knew it. Whatever he did with anybody else, she knew it. And I wanted that thing to be mentioned. And you have to look, too. We're talking about 1962 and 63. You know, it had only been about 60 years before that black men were trained to have a lot of women and make a lot of babies. So it takes a very long time to, if you were born left-handed, to learn to eat with your right hand. And that's what was happening in 1960. It was the first time we ever made any money, the first time we were able to cavort with all the white folks. We lived a different life, were trained a different way, thought nothing about what it was we were doing. Certainly there were ministers and God-sayers and whatever. Most of them were involved in everything that we were doing as well. They just, you know, you just didn't know it. But I'm talking about a different period and a different group of people. And I think that's my only qualms with the book. It's just that people who are reading or who have read it thus far are trying to compare it to what you think now and what would happen now. I mean, I don't know anything in the book that any of us would have go on in our lives now. Not any of us. And I'm very, very proud of all of those people. I mean, all the years that things were not working for me, whenever I did get the opportunity to travel, if I was talking with someone who only spoke a little English, I would say Soul Singer, Motown, Supremes. I would say those words and they would know them. I'm very proud of that. You know, I'm very proud of what they've turned into. But what I'm talking about in the book is not those people at all. It's who they started out to be. From Berry Gordy and his mama and daddy to the last one.
Well,
and I have no qualms. I have no qualms with that, because while I don't know that had I become the big star that they have, that I would want to be as open as I've been. But you have to realize that this has only been happening to me for 8 or 9 years. Just before this, these stories I'm telling in the book were the only story I had. You know, that was all I knew to tell. That was what happened to me in my life, and that was what I told. And as I said, if I had become the same star that the rest of them had become, maybe I'd want to look a little bit more like Mary who had a little lamb myself.
Well, anyway, hey, I am honored to have anything to do with you and
Thank
the
you,
book
David.
And the story, and I love you very much. And
So a guy with tattoos all over him likes me.
Who cares about that? But so you're going to autograph, and we appreciate everybody. And
thank you so much for being here.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.